Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY Allentown, listener-supported community public radio. I'm your host, John Pierce, joined today by Joe Rovner at the board. Thanks, Joe. Our topic today is collaborative arts production. Is that a good way to say it, Peggy?
Art collaboration, collaborative arts production, they both work.
And that was Peggy Campbell, and I'm going to introduce her. And also Anthony Maricini.
I'll save you that.
Not Maricini.
No, well, you can if you want.
Peggy Campbell of Easton has a bachelor degree in French from Muhlenberg College. We've known each other for over 40 years.
Open disclosure.
There you go. And she, after the years at Muhlenberg, she went on for a master's in comparative literature from NYU. She studied with Gilbert Sorrentino and Marguerite Young, and in 1995 edited a book entitled Family, A Celebration, which is a collection of essays, poems, and short stories about contemporary and non-traditional families. And Peggy, that also has beautiful pictures in it.
Yes, photographs are by Joan Beard.
Since 2003, Peggy, and she uses Margaret Campbell, I guess, officially, is that right?
Yes, that is my official name, and I think whenever I get anything having to do with finances, I've had to use them.
All right. So since 2003, she has worked with fellow artists to bring language and art together in the following installations at Lafayette College, Northampton Community College, and galleries in Long Island City. Now, these are the installations. One is Physical Sentences, James Joyce, Gertrude Stein, and Samuel Beckett. Another one is House Dress, The Sheltering Dream. Another, Reading the Shared Hallucination. And another one, I Stand Here Ironing, Homage to Tilly Olson. Ooh, what a title. Can't wait to hear what that's about. And then Linguaduct, Diagrammed Sentences from Here is New York. The Journal of the American Medical Association published her poem, Still Life Within the Painter's Heart, in its July 4th, 2012 issue, and will publish Hands in a future issue. The Hands is a poem that Peggy wrote, and Peggy, I would like for you to read that as we get into our program this evening. Anthony Maricini is a graduate of Northampton Community College, a painter in his own right, but since he took Connections over... Oh, Connections, what's that?
Oh, Connections Art Gallery in Easton. We, Alice Kwiatkowska and I purchased that in late 2003. It's a local regional contemporary art gallery. It's been in existence since 1990.
And so we're talking 22 years.
It's probably the longest running local regional contemporary art gallery in Lehigh Valley.
And it's right on the main drag, Northampton Street.
213.
And that's called Connections with an X.
Correct.
He and his partner Alice have made Easton a place where the highest quality of art, music, and poetry come together with admirable consistency. He has also been president of ACE.
ACE, yes.
What is ACE?
ACE stands for the Arts Community of Easton. It's the local arts group in Easton. It was congealed around 1990, but then formalized in 2005. I became president in 2004 when we took over the gallery, and I've been there ever since. So we do a lot of different activities in town. One of the big things we do is Riverside Festival of the Arts every September. And then we have some exhibitions we do around Lehigh Valley, and we partner up where we can with different entities such as the State Theater, the Siegel Museum, Nurture Nature Center. We try to be a community-based arts organization.
Many things going on in Easton. Uh-huh. And Peggy, you also live in Easton.
Yes.
And so do I. That makes three of us. That makes the hat trick.
Uh-oh.
As I've presented you, perhaps the listeners have caught that Peggy is more into language. You're a poet, and you're working with language more than the visual arts, and that Anthony is definitely visual arts.
Amongst other things, sure. I mean, I do poetry, and I do music at the gallery as well. You know, so when Peggy and I had this conversation when she came over to the gallery today to sort of solidify what we're going to discuss. And I'm an all-over collaborative individual. I think that there's more is better than less.
Wow. All right. And I also want to mention that Anthony, the work that I know best of Anthony happens to be at a restaurant.
It is.
Called the Brick House Tavern.
Oh, yeah.
In Easton on Butler Street. And it's a huge mural. Mm-hmm. And I asked Anthony off the air if he had finished that mural because my wife and I go in there sometimes and we look up and we say, oh, it looks as if there are a few windows missing in that skyscraper. So I'm asking. He said, no, it's a work in progress. Is that right?
Yeah, it's become a labor of love. It's a very large piece, and it's just, with my schedule being what it is, considering running an art gallery, and I'm, you know, I I run a magazine too, The Elucidator. So it's very time consuming. I do my best to get up there when I can. I feel a little, I don't know, poorly, but I haven't finished it yet. But I'll do my best.
But if you want to eat some really top-notch hummus, that is the place.
I see. I like their cheese fries.
To each his own. Mm-hmm. So, Peggy, what is collaborative art? What does that mean?
Collaborative art simply is artists working together. We tend to think of the artist alone in the studio, but art has a long tradition of being a very social enterprise. Whether artists are working together on a particular painting or project is uncommon, but artists socializing and coming together around art, it has a long tradition. Probably the most famous collaborative art example in art history would be the collaboration between George Braque and Pablo Picasso to create Cubism. In the past 10 years or so, I think collaborative art has gained more acceptance and popularity, actually, in the art world.
Does feminism play into this? It seems to me as if all this business about cooperation, you know, getting together and all that is sort of the feminist stream. Does that, now, not with Picasso and Braque, but...
No. In our situation, I came together with a number of other women who were actually mothers of children in the Eastern Area School District. So for us, there was a common woman's identity. We were working together to make art at a time when it was very difficult for us to do it. It was not necessarily that we were thinking in terms of the feminist movement, but there was for us in particular that sense of women
right.
working together.
And you say it was difficult for you to do your art because?
Because of our responsibilities as working women and as parents, and we were trying to make time for our art.
And what decade did you start all that?
What we're talking about here in terms of the collaborative art projects were in 2000s. We're really in the 2003, 2004 up to the present. Me personally, I go back to the 1970s.
Right. Well, that's all right.
With some feminists, I have a feminist. I was a part of the Feminist Writers Guild, and I had our friend Carol Grenner was a professor at Muhlenberg College who was a great inspiration to me. And those were the days of the women's movement in the 70s and the 80s.
Right. She was a colleague of mine
force.
And, yes, a strong voice on campus in those days for women. And I heard her say one time, the one thing, and I thought what she was going to say was, I want women to have a career. But she didn't. She said, the one thing that I want to try to help avoid is that a woman stops using her mind. And that's, I think, the broadest way that you can explain that. So, Carol Grenner, bless her. And she was one of your big influences in college. Did you have any particular influences before you came to college as far as arts, writing?
I think most writers will tell you that writing goes back. Their sense of themselves as a writer, their impulse to write, can frequently go back to the first time that they get a pencil in their hand or a pen. So it's hard to kind of, you know, track it. But at some point in a writer's life, there's a sense that the way they inhabit the world is a little bit different from the way other people inhabit the world. And it has to do something with language and something with paper and pencils and pens. But Carol Grenner, I thank her for being the one who took me aside and said, Peggy, I'm not sure you realize it, but you are a writer. I think every artist has someone in there who affirms them as an artist and a writer, and I appreciate that.
And it's interesting because she told me one time, now her major was French language and literature. And she told me one time, if I had to do it over again, I would do comparative literature. And so I wonder if she sort of pushed you in that direction toward NYU.
I don't know. You know, foreign languages have always been important to me, and comparative literature gets you to look at literatures in multiple languages, which meant a lot to me. When we were working on the collaborative art projects, we would bring every collaborative art project that we did and involved a text. And I did not do this alone. I worked with other artists. Mary Zangit was one of my partners. Maggie Paré, who's a dress designer, was another partner, and a woman named Tess Mondello. So Dimitris Stamos, a photographer. So it's a group of us. We came together on different projects, and we weren't all working on all the projects. But in every case, literature was the focus of the projects. Starting with our first collaborative project was called Physical Sentences, and in Physical Sentences, we took the writings of Samuel Beckett and Gertrude Stein and James Joyce. We started with Finnegan's Wake, a book that most people think is unreadable. So we decided we would read one sentence from Finnegan's Wake, and we would diagram it, which is
how many pages did that sentence happen to run?
It was about 2 pages. Right. And I diagrammed the sentence, and Mary Zangit did a sort of a physical a writing of the sentence on a large shower curtain. And that sentence was 11 feet tall. The diagram sentence was 11 feet tall. We also took a text from Patriarch or Poetry by Gertrude Stein, and we took material from Samuel Beckett's Molloy. So that was the beginning of this collaboration of literature and art. And then the first really gallery-driven collaborative art project was for the Unwearable Show in 2004 at Lafayette College. And in that show, we produced something called House Dress, The Sheltering Dream. And there we used Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse as our text. So this, my work as a student of Carol Grenner's and as a literature major in comparative literature, this was all coming into these projects. But the artists were taking a text and then turning it into an installation, which would be a combination of sculpture and some kind of almost like theater.
Wow. All these arts coming together. And Anthony, you've already mentioned that you're interested in more than painting.
Sure.
I know you for painting. But do you have some influences in the early years that you could point to?
Well, I echo what Peggy's saying. You know, you grow up just as somebody that does something differently, or you express yourself slightly differently. So I'm not sure why the visual language comes to me as a way of doing that. It just does as a young person. But much to the same as her experience when I got to NCC, I was adrift slightly as to what I wanted to do. It's not an easy decision to say, oh, I'm going to go into the arts. I'm going to be a creative individual and seek a life of that. So I was able to meet up with Gerald Rowan, and he gave me sort of the posture I needed to go forward. And that's how I got to Tyler. And that's where I got my BFA.
And what happened when you told your parents, I want to be an artist?
My mother was aware that was the case. She's very supportive in that regard.
Excellent.
I think, conversely, my father had like a concern, you know, especially from a financial point of view. So I fibbed and said I was going to get my teaching certification when in reality I'm truly a painter at heart in that regard.
There was a magician recently at the State Theater named David Caserta, and I went to see one of his shows, excellent magic show. And one of the lines that he uses is, when I was in college, I wanted to be a doctor, but my parents wanted me to be a magician.
We were wondering if there are parents out there who want their children to be who they really are, and it's a great mission for a parent.
That is a great statement, to be what you really are. You've talked, Peggy, about your collaborative work with Mary Zangit and with others. What was your first collaborative project? Did you already mention that?
Well, the House Dress was the one that was the most, the first real one for a gallery.
And describe that for us. What, if we're looking at it, what are we seeing?
Yeah, House Dress, House Dress started out after there had been a very, very sad attack on a little girl in Catasauqua. And we came together thinking, what can we do to protect children? And it was this sense of a women or mothers wanting to do something to create a shelter for children. So the house dress, a sheltering dream, came out of that sense. Maggie Paré was a dress designer. She had a very, very tall form that you would use for designing clothing. And so we used that form to create a 10-foot-high installation that involved a garment with a large hoop skirt, and around the bottom of the skirt we created a kind of nest. And in the nest we put twigs. The nest was made of twigs at the bottom of the skirt, and in that we put all sorts of domestic items, including these dolls that were blank dolls, and some books and other materials. And then out of the headdress, we didn't have a face or anything like that, but on the top of this form we had a giant headdress. And then words from Virginia Woolf's text came out of that headdress in large ribbons. It was very striking when you went into the Lafayette College's gallery and you saw this giant form. It was quite striking, actually.
Is this a sculpture that would be in the middle of the room? People would walk around it?
Yes, yes, yes.
And once that exhibition is over, does that get destroyed, or do you keep it somewhere?
There were some people in that show, the Unwearables show, who kept whose work was circulated in other shows around the country, actually. But our house, we never submitted our house dress to any other show. It was a one-time thing.
Okay. An example of what you created is this house dress show. What interests me is that you're doing not only literature, painting, but you're also bringing in a dress designer into your collaborative work here. And I wouldn't have thought of that.
Yeah, Maggie Paré was also an artist in her own, not a painter, but she had an artistic side to her. And so Maggie was able to actually create the garment and the skirt. We did a lot of research for this. We did a lot of research around African nomadic dwellings. We did a lot of research about the history of, you know, clothing. I mean, it was months and months of work to get to the project.
It sounds like it. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY. I'm John Pierce, your host, and I'm speaking today with Peggy Campbell and with Anthony Maricini about their work in collaborative arts. Time to take a break. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
For program support on WDIY, we thank the Cedar Crest College School of Adult and Graduate Education, offering graduate programs and professional certificates to further your education and strengthen your resume. Learn more at sagecedarcrest.edu, sage.cedarcrest.edu.
And we're back on Lehigh Valley Discourse. John Pierce with you, speaking with Peggy Campbell and with Anthony Maricini, both, as it happens, from Easton. So they are both local artists. Anthony, let's talk a little bit about Connections Gallery, which is your baby over in Easton.
Sure.
On Northampton Street.
Yes.
What does that mean? W-E.
Well, there was a show that was put together called the We Experiment that we curated and installed in the gallery. It was actually organized by an artist, Danny Moyer, who's out of Penn Argyle, but it's his brainchild, really. He came to us with the concept back in 2010 is when we did the first one. So it's a biannual. We just did another one a couple months back.
And if we look at that, what are we seeing?
Well, the We is this it's this large-scale collaborative concept with about 120 artists. And we take, I think they're 12 by 12 panels of MDF, and you come and you pick one up, and it's yours.
Are you saying 12 inches by 12
inches? Yes, yes. Right. And so you pick up a panel, and with the assumption that there'll be two people after you who've worked on it, and you do something to it, you drop it off, you pick up another panel that's already been worked on, you do something to that, bring it back, drop it off, pick up a third one. So each panel has had three artists work on it, and each artist has worked on three panels, and they're blind exchanges. So there's no way to the collaborative process can be disingenuous, where you're like, oh, we're going to steer it towards something. You don't get that. You're just, here it is, do what you want with it. And then the artist has to figure out how to balance their ego versus the desire to come up with an end product that's something.
I was just going to say, your ego has to disappear to some extent when you're adding to someone else's, and then you know someone else is going to be adding to yours.
In theory. I mean, you hope so. You hope that the people that can – you hope that artists can find a way to collaborate via not the ego specifically, that they'll see the product as an end product and say, how do I make this a better end product, as opposed to how do I put my mark on it more so than the person before me, right, or the next person after me. That's not always the case, and that's part of the process, no doubt, and you'll see that when you put them on the wall.
Now, when you're talking about these panels, the 12-inch by 12-inch, is it all painting that's being done?
Sorts of stuff. Whatever can be applied to a surface, you know, or even like carved into a surface, though I try to get artists to not necessarily do that because the MDF isn't a very carvable thing. But you'll see lots of three-dimensional aspects to the work where it comes protruding forward. There's writers who will write on it. Beth Siege, a poet, she did it, and she wrote a poem of hers on one of them.
What's the material? Does she use a felt pen or?
No, I had to recall. I mean, there's 120 panels. I don't remember exactly every piece of material, but it was something that was written on a ribbon that went around in a circle. It was probably some form of a marker. Right. One artist even went so far as to put something on a thumb drive and attach the thumb drive to one of the pieces.
And you're saying there's 120 artists involved in the whole project.
120 panels, yeah.
Now, and this lasted for months?
Well, any show at that Connections will last 4 to 6 weeks, depending on the show. I think that one was a 5.5-week show.
But to get 120 artists to do all this collaboration, that's what I'm asking.
To get them collectively to come together?
Right.
Well, the process of creation of the Wii panels goes, it's about a 6-week process from beginning to end. You get 2 weeks in between each cycle. But getting artists to cooperate is another story. Yeah, like show up on time, drop off on time. That's something. Yeah, but there's no dearth of artists in the Lehigh Valley. And if you're wired into a network, we could have done 180 if we gave a little more time for
and
people to respond.
All artists from the Lehigh Valley?
Well, yeah, you have to branch out your concept of Lehigh Valley into New Jersey too. Yeah. Oh. If you talk about that, what we call the metropolitan area of Lehigh Valley.
Do you consider yourself basically a painter, or do you? You said that you spread out and you do different things, including music and poetry. And so, do you have one thing that, if you had to do only that, you would choose?
Well, the music part, I was talking more collectively from the gallery point of view. If you're trying to put me in a box, from an educational point of view, where I went to school, I have a BFA in painting with art history minor. So I'm a classically trained figure artist with a bent towards realism, but I also do collaborative concepts with material and text. Like, so for instance, I had a show at Connections that was interactive. The audience participated. But I'm also a poet, and part of my conceptual work that I do has text involved and is more autobiographical.
How did the audience interact with you on it?
Well, one of the pieces I had was, it had a sign I made out of styrofoam that said confess on it, and then on beneath that was a shelf, and then you had 7 stamps, like those ones you just put in paper, and they were 7 sins, the 7 deadly sins, and underneath that was a pedestal, and on the pedestal was a journal box, and then the journal box was a journal, and you were meant to stamp yourself with a sin or sins that applied the most, and then you were supposed
to
write your confession.
Stamp yourself.
Yeah,
stamp
your hand.
On your hand.
Uh-huh.
During, and then,
I think that was during the opening, and so everybody's stamping themselves, and they would write down why they said that. So I had this book full of confessions. Some are larks, some people being jocular, had a couple of drinks, ha-ha, but some are real deep things that, I wasn't really expecting that much personal give back, but it was touching to have some people say, my sin is gluttony. I have the hardest time not eating food. I use it for comfort. And I thought that was, very telling that someone even like go so far as to put that out there. But I didn't know who it was. I didn't need to know who it was, but they still were able to articulate that.
So people did this at the beginning of the exhibit? Or?
Well, it was another 4 to 6 week show at Connections. And primarily that first opening, the opening is where you get the core
big
of people coming through. Exactly. So I had 100 or so people at the opening, and most of them participated in that aspect of it.
I think one of the really important things about what Anthony's saying is the fact that frequently people stand in front of a work of art and are so confused about how to respond to the work of art. You know, what does this expect? You know, what is the artist trying to tell me? What does this work expect of me? What do I expect of the work? And to have a piece like what Anthony's describing, where there's actually communication between the artist or the artwork, because the artist isn't actually standing there, the artwork is standing there on the wall, and the person who's looking at it is really important in the respect that it helps us to understand that art is something that that we can respond to in our own way, and I think these collaborative art projects are very, when we talk about the ego stepping back, and certainly in the 120 artists coming together to create the We Project, and even in our work where we had, you know, four or five people coming together, there still had to be that sense that we were about something larger than ourselves. The art piece is actually the thing that we're working on, whether it's an installation or a piece of artwork, is actually not just an extension of the artist. It's something that exists outside the artist. And as a result, the ego is really not, the piece is not necessarily a reflection of the artist. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And as you said at the beginning of the interview, we think mostly that artwork is an individual endeavor. So the matter of getting a team together to do some art, you generally don't think of it in those terms. We see the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, and we say, "Well, Michelangelo did the whole thing. Amazing, you know, all by himself. He had somebody to hoist him up there."
That's a farce, but yeah, I get what you're saying. Well, I think that's more, and that could be like an Americanized notion of things too, or a Westernized notion of things of how we see the rugged individualist. But I'm more keen on what Peggy's saying about how art and creativity is a larger ideal. Is a collaborative process between the artist and his audience if he's going to have a sense of communication in any regard. Otherwise, it's just, well, hey, look at me. Which, there's a place for that, I suppose, especially when we get from modernism to postmodernism. That's a big portion of what's being created. But as an individual, I find collaboration as just more of a quote-unquote global notion. Like, how do you bring forces together? How do you use art to coalesce people, as opposed to, hey, this is me, I don't really care about the rest of you?
When you create art, either Anthony, I'm thinking more in the plastic arts, and Peggy with poetry, you have a certain message that you're conveying. Do you care whether people who see your work respond in the way that you might have imagined that you wanted them to respond, or do you not care how they respond? Two people could see the same painting or sculpture and just get different things from it. Is that okay?
Well, of course. I mean, that's the only way it's going to be. I don't think you could. I mean, that's really myopic to think that you can make a piece of work and everybody's going to have the same opinion. I think my standard is love it, hate it, at least I got a reaction. It's when someone's indifferent that I think the piece has failed. So that should be your goal. Your goal should be to get a reaction, because, you know, some people like black, some people like white. That's just the way it is.
And I think when you consider all the writing that gets accomplished around a work of art or a piece of literature, one poem by Emily Dickinson or T.S. Eliot has generated you know, reams and reams and reams of writing about the work and how people responded to it. It's only, I think, from the artist's point of view, that is an incredibly rich, enriching part of the process of creating, to think that you could create something that could stimulate other people to think other things than what you thought, and to continue the invention process, in a sense, gives great, I think, merit to the work that we call art. The Lehigh Valley is actually a very rich place in the arts, and I would like to just put a little plug in for arts in education.
Sure.
And how important it is for children to have access to art experiences at the earliest moment, preschool, infancy. We know, you know, that children benefit from early exposure to arts, and our and communities in which there's a richness of the arts is really important.
You can tell when you walk into a school sometime, thinking about elementary schools and even preschools, when you see a lot of art around, especially on the walls that the children have done, that there is some adult or adults behind that who are really interested in promoting this appreciation of art that the children will have. And they're not going to turn out to be professional artists. That's fine. It's an exposure for them to be able to express themselves that way. And some later in life, it's going to give them great pleasure to be able to continue that or to appreciate the kind of work that the two of you produce in the end.
Well, I think that there's also a power to creativity that's, to what Peggy's saying about education, that's being lost in some regards on the general public. If we don't push people to be creative somehow, be it art, music, poetry, dance, whatever, they won't know how to express themselves. They won't understand creative processes. So there's linear thinking, there's creative thinking. You can't really apply linear thinking all the time. Sometimes creativity is how you create a solution to a problem. But if we only say, oh, A to B equals C, and that's the only thing we're going to teach, you're really limiting a young person's ability to see past the problem. It's not just about pretty pictures and good music. It's about how a person's brain operates. So there's a whole movement in education about how to inject creativity into the educational process. It's a much more powerful notion than let's make kids feel happy about pretty pictures.
Well said. Peggy Campbell and Anthony Maracini are my guests today on Lehigh Valley Discourse, and we're talking about collaborative arts. Peggy, teamwork, working in groups. We're talking a lot about that today in schools and in jobs. What have you learned together from these projects that others might be able to apply to their experiences?
I think the first thing we experienced when we came together to create an installation was the chaos of uncertainty. Busy people coming together have to agree that what we're going to do is going to be worth our time, that we're going to create something that we will believe in. But in the beginning of the process, there's no certainty about that. So the beginning of an artistic experience is a moment of great uncertainty and confusion, and being able to live with that is really important. Chaos, confusion, uncertainty. After you get to the point where you realize that this is starting to come together and it's starting to make sense, or you can see where you're going, then the ego becomes an important thing to wrestle with, and to make sure that every time you get together, no one person tries to dominate. No one person is getting credit as being the leader or the primary. And in the We project, it's even more
happenstance.
Fantastic.
Yeah. It's up for grabs in that regard.
You describe it as random and anonymous, right?
It's fairly random and fairly anonymous. I mean, you're even working with different levels of talent, skill, and experience, from children all the way up to, you know, adults who've never ever tried anything like that, or people, like I said, who are writers and aren't visual artists in any regard. So yeah, it's a little more random. But then back to the notion of chaos. I mean, chaos is everywhere. We walk around in this concept. Oh, we live in a society. I live in a world. Everything's chaos. You walk out the front door, it's chaos. Look outside the window now, it's raining like cats and dogs.
Last year it was Irene, and then in October we had Sandy, right?
Yes,
so
the chaos
talking
of
about
weather.
Natural chaos, right?
So I'm saying, like, you know, when you look at creativity, and what Peggy's talking about, that's what we discussed a second ago about education. That's the power of creativity. It can create order out of chaos. It can make something out of nothing. So look at the pyramids. How did you make the pyramids? I don't know. I didn't even understand geometry back then. One brick at a time. We learned. So I think that's the power of the We thing, is you get the We experiment. You get to know who. I learned so much about so many different people through the We experiment. It was really, to me, a fabulous experiment.
The other thing I think about creativity and about the collaboration, that as a writer, I sit alone in a room and create, let's say, a story or a poem. But even if I'm not working with another person, I never feel as if that text that I'm preparing is my work alone. It's the work of all my writing mentors, of all the writers that have inspired me. In my case, it would be someone like Virginia Woolf and Gertrude Stein and T.S. Eliot and James Joyce. These are they're there, you know. Even if I put one word down, they're there. And then all the people whose stories I've heard on the street or in a coffee shop or, you know, eavesdropping or family, they're all there. So in a sense, you know, that's their collaborators as well on this project, even if I can't give credit to everyone.
That's well said, too, because we stand on the shoulders of many, many, many people from past generations. Anthony talked about studying art history.
Correct.
If you had to choose between, say, teaching art history and teaching studio art, which would you choose?
Oh, I had to pick studio art. I'm not that. I'm just not that pedantic to know dates and names and stuff. What I took away from art history was more of the evolution of visual learning and visual expression and how that is a reflection of society's evolution. You know, you go through from the Quai de Lascaux all the way up to postmodernism. That tells you the evolution of the human psyche and how we get along with each other. So that's about all I could teach. I could teach that in an afternoon and be done.
But I think those caves, we've talked a little bit about this before, that those caves seem like the first collaborative art projects. We have no evidence of this, but that when you go into the caves and you see the art that has been put on the walls in Spain and in France, and you get the sense that there's more than one person recording something that was deeply felt. The idea of I have to say that Connections, being a resident of Easton, much I appreciate what Connections has brought to the Easton community, and really would like to compliment.
Right. A shout out to Connections.
Yeah,
well, thank you. I'm blushing though, so we can tell.
Anthony, again, who are your collaborators with Connections?
Well, it's primarily Alice Kwiatkowski. She's sort of my partner in crime in most ways, and then the community itself come out to, you know, show their support and involve themselves at the space. Like, so one of the things that I talk about a lot of times is that Connections as a mindset is non-competitive. It's a place where people can come with ideas and see what they can make happen there. It's just like Danny did with the Weep experiment. We've done other things where
you have the open mic.
We have open mics. We do music on a regular basis. We're talking about doing some theatrical things in the garden next year. We've done things like Sakar, which was this dancing drawing situation. We've done some performance art, but we're open to people coming in expressing themselves as best they can, however they can. We do ask for a modicum of adulthood and talent, skill. You know, I don't think that that's too much to ask for, especially from a commercial, professional gallery. But we do our best to be as open as possible.
And how do you promote these events? How do you advertise for people to know?
Well, we do our best with what we have. And the economy being what it is, we've had to make some changes. So we do a lot of Facebook promotions. We also print postcards that we distribute. And then, like I said, I have the Elucidator magazine. I use that as a vehicle through which to promote not just Connections, but the art scene in general.
And that's a free publication.
It is indeed. It's a free quarterly.
And do you go to Easton Now as well on the web?
What is it? I'm sorry. Mr.
Easton Now.
Oh, you mean that the website that the EBA created?
Yes.
I'm remiss in that regard. I can't be in every place at one time. I used to have an assistant before the economy turned, you know, so I took more on my shoulders.
I think that's free advertising.
It is free.
As well.
It is free. So. I do pollute other people's Facebooks with things. Like, you know, you put them on their wall. There's a group on Facebook called Lehigh Valley Artist Community that I use quite often. And I do what I can as an artist trying to be a business person. I do my very best.
Right. Excellent. Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY. We're ready to take another break, and we'll be back in 60 seconds.
For program support on WDIY, we thank Touchstone Theater on Bethlehem's South Side, presenting Christmas City Follies 13, directed by J.P. Jordan, created and performed by the Touchstone Ensemble. This annual classic, yet again, reimagines what the holidays are all about with music, wit, and holiday hijinks. November 29th to December 22nd. For tickets or information, 610-867-1689 or touchstone.org.
And we're back on Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm chatting this evening with Peggy Campbell and with Anthony Maracini. It happens that both of them are from Easton. Both are artists in their own right, and we are exploring collaborative arts. Anthony, you were just saying off the air.
Oh, about the power of arts and collaboration and community, and how that I feel like that's something that should be. We could at least discuss this today because it's such a, to me anyway, I could be my own best supporter in that regard. I think the arts are a very powerful way to bridge gaps in communities. I was saying to Peggy the other day that, you can always tell a healthy community because it has a healthy art scene. If you don't have a healthy art scene, that means people aren't communicating with each other. So that to me, when you talk about collaboration, we start to talk about this global notion of collaboration through the arts or through creativity, that it's at its localized level, that's the global notion. How do you get people to reach across boundaries? And I think the arts can do that.
I lived in New York City for about 20 years before coming back to the Lehigh Valley. And so much of the experience of being in this big city, New York City, that turns out to be civilized is through art in the subway, mostly in the subway. I think of the subway in New York City as a place that can be a very scary, very cold, very difficult place to navigate. But the city of New York has given art a primary role in the society of New York City. And I think people, because of that, because when you go into the subway, you see paintings and tile work and musicians playing, and all of that is supported, as I understand it, by the city in some way. At least it's if it's not funded, it's given some kind of permission. So I think communities that can do that kind of thing, give the arts a role to play in the health and vitality of the community, can take a lesson from New York City. New York City would be a much more difficult place to live if it weren't for the arts there. I think what Anthony's saying is very important for the Lehigh Valley. In the Lehigh Valley, we have so much to draw from in terms of music, art, dance, theater, talented people.
Absolutely. And with the educational institutions we have here.
Yes.
Museums, it's such a great place to live. So are you, Peggy, are you promoting a subway for the Lehigh Valley?
Light rail would be nice.
Light rail would be nice.
So you could get to Philadelphia and
New York
easily?
That's transit. We need a whole new approach to transit. But dovetailing on what Peggy was saying, if you were to take what she experiences in the subway and just erase it, what do you have? What kind of experiences would you have in life? So if you were to take things like connections and the Payne Gallery and the Grossman and the Williams Center, and just eliminate that from the Lehigh Valley experience, what do you have as culture?
That would also include Arts Quest.
Sure.
And Music
Fest.
DIY.
You take all that out of the pantheon, and what do you have? You don't really have a whole lot. And then you have to. The hard part there is to get the local population to understand, embrace, and respect what's here. They tend to embrace the exotic. I want to go to New York, go to Philly. But there's like Peggy said, there's so much here in the Lehigh Valley that we could all be enriching ourselves off of.
Right, and you go to a campus like one of the campuses here in the Lehigh Valley. It was said years ago to me, there are too many activities for you to attend them all. And we're not talking about a huge place like Penn State. We're talking about these colleges that have roughly 2,000 students. Mm-hmm. They're bringing in programs all the time, and there's theater, and there are lectures, and the art galleries themselves. There's just a whole lot, Anthony. That's true right here in the Lehigh Valley.
One of the projects that we worked on was actually exhibited in a real estate office. it was exhibited in Long Island City, and it was called Linguaduct, and it was an installation to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Queensboro Bridge, which connects Manhattan with Queens. Queens is a borough that has more languages spoken in it than any other place, actually, in the world.
Wow. Do you remember
Queens
how many languages?
Well, I think there are 80. I don't want to be. I'm sorry. I don't want to be specific about this right now. But we had 80 languages that we were working with when we were working on the project. But I think it's many more than that that are spoken in Queens. So we came up with this idea of a replica of the Queensboro Bridge. We called it Linguaduct because we thought of how every day people going between Manhattan and Queens speak all these languages. So it's kind of like a language bridge, Linguaduct, like aqueduct, Linguaduct. And then we took an essay from E.B. White. There's a famous essay called Here is New York that we were all very much in love with. And we took we diagrammed 36 sentences from E.B. White's essay, Here is New York. E.B. White was a writer who had written Charlotte's Web.
My favorite story.
Really?
Yes.
Charlotte's Web. And then E.B. White was also a New Yorker writer and quite celebrated as a person who wrote essays as well and letters. And in many ways, E.B. White, I think, he's the opposite of the eccentric romantic artist. he's your very, very understandable and approachable friend. So we took his essay, Here is New York, and I diagrammed the 36 sentences from it, and we actually used the sentences to create the latticework of the bridge. When you look at the Queensboro Bridge, you always see it from a little angle, and it looks like lace. It was a very successful installation, and it was in a real estate office. We heard over the months that it was there that people were coming to see it from all over, actually, including some monks who had come, who'd heard about it when they came into Manhattan and they made this trip over to Long Island City. But once again, it was a project that when it was dismantled, it didn't go. We weren't able to put it anyplace else. But the other point I wanted to make is this question of language and words. The diagramming of sentences doesn't have a great reputation in pedagogical history.
Right. Children used to hate that when we were back in our school days. And I don't know if they're still doing that.
I don't recall that myself.
But no. Anthony's too young.
Maybe, but maybe I'm just forgetting on purpose.
And you don't even probably, Anthony, really know about how much it was hated.
Yeah, I don't know. I took a logics class in college, and I was like, okay.
That was bad enough, right?
Well, you know, it was terribly informative, but I was always like, catching it afterwards. Like, so I'd take the test and fail, but then I'd figure it out after that. I was like, oh, now I get it.
I think that the writer in me found the experience of taking a sentence and really, really interacting with every word to be very exciting. So there are some of us who actually like diagramming sentences. And when I studied French, the study of French, there's something called explication du texte, where you explicate a poem word by word. This attention to language is very satisfying if you're a writer, but it's not for everyone. In any event, we found that the diagram sentence has fit into a number of our projects. It hasn't fit into all of them, but it has fit into a number of them. And I have to say, for me, it's almost like a form of meditation. Diagramming a sentence is a pleasure. I would go to work and I'd come home at night and I would sit down and I would diagram like five sentences.
You do that instead of working crossword
puzzles.
Instead
of watching
puzzles,
television.
Interesting.
But just out of curiosity, because it's in the dark on it, what exactly is the result of diagramming a sentence?
You end up with a framework. It looks almost like some kind of a chart or a bridge
superstructure.
Yeah,
almost.
Yeah, almost like fire escapes. I mean, there's a visual element to it that is visually satisfying. But the end result is that you really can understand how the words, the the role that the words play in the sentence, what function they have.
We're talking parts of speech here.
But it's not about coming to a conclusion on its truthfulness or lack thereof.
No.
Because that's logic. That's what I'm trying to...
No.
We're trying to put those two together somehow in my brain. I guess I'm off.
No. But...
it's simply the structure of the sentence.
Gotcha.
Itself.
Yeah. But...
And I did not study that.
In the case of V.B. White's Here's New York, the... we did learn a lot, actually, about the essay through the diagram sentences, and but I think what I do think that children today need to access language in some way that is not a diagram sentence, because I think that would be probably terrible for children today, but something that is playful and engaging and it feels like a game with language, which to me was diagram sentencing. That was a game, something similar that can help children really understand the meaning of every word and how language is put together.
And when you did that project, the Linguaduct, about the Queensboro Bridge, you mentioned meandering in New York City. Tell us a little bit about that. Sounds so much like an artist.
I love that word, though, meandering.
Meandering. Actually, as we worked on that project, those of us who were working on it went into New York City, and we did meander through the city, stopping in little cafes, sitting down and making our little plans for the project and looking at the bridge from various places. The Queensboro Bridge is most famous for being in the Woody Allen film Manhattan. So that's the bridge that, if those of you who know the film, that's the bridge that you see when Woody Allen and, is it Diane Keaton?
I suppose. I don't know that.
I don't know either.
Okay, yeah, anyway, they're sitting on a little
bench. Once again, in the dark.
Can you help us out here?
Anyway.
No? Woody Allen fan?
It's a very, very famous image.
I think Joe's younger than me, so I don't know.
It's not Annie Hall.
No, it's not Annie Hall. This would be Manhattan.
It's called Manhattan.
Yeah, so... but we also did a project homage to Tilly Olson, which was I Stand Here Ironing, which was at the Northampton Community College when they were first inhabiting the Southside campus.
The Some Serious Business show.
Yes,
yeah,
the Some
that's
Serious,
the part
which
I
was,
remember.
Wasn't that an amazing show?
Talk about collaborative.
And what was the title of the show?
Some Serious Business. Joseph Chapik, he's a adjunct over at NCC when they took over the Fowler Building.
Well, on the south side.
Yeah, that's what it's called now.
The old
part of steel. Yeah, the first floor was deemed not used, and they let Mick Chapik and his students and a bunch of artists come in and make a mess out of the rooms. And I don't know who was in the room with you, but I had one of the rooms, and I had this like really pristine black wall thing with figure work on it. Some of the other rooms were like, wow, that's like totally off the hook. And I think that's where Danny initially gets this Wii experiment concept from. He starts interacting with these other artists on the one room he had. They all painted the walls together, and then it branches off of that to how can I get these 3-4 dozen people I just met at this show to work together on some other show? And I don't remember the room entirely, but I remember it being like a house in there. I remember the ironing board thing too.
We used a story by Tilly Olson called "I Stand Here Ironing," and we created a kind of tenement neighborhood. With clothing hanging on a clothesline and an ironing board, and then we had the story by Tilly Olson playing on a tape recorder. But that Some Serious Business was really, really a terrific Lehigh Valley experiment and experience. Unfortunately, never quite repeated, right?
It happened twice.
Okay.
It was called More Serious Business.
Okay.
In my mind, it wasn't as successful as the first one, but I think the first one was successful in the sense that it did things outside of the building afterwards. Because the Lehigh Valley as a region can be extremely provincial. Let's just be honest, especially when it comes to art. You could be provincial from neighborhood to neighborhood. This was an experience where we were able to come together, and from it came these interactions that are continuing today. Like I said, Danny Moyer came up with the Wii experiment, at least in my mind. I have to ask him to clarify for sure, that from this show.
And again, let's make clear that the Wii experiment is W-E. This is not
specifically
a video game.
Lowercase. Yeah, it's specifically lowercase, and it's in quotation marks, the Wii part. Because what his whole thing was, how to make it about us as opposed to an individual, back to the whole collaborative notion. He was really insistent that it be a community concept, so he called it We on purpose.
When you get artists together to work in a team like this, Do you sometimes find that certain artists don't want to do this and they back out?
Oh, certainly. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's back to the ego. You know, I have friends who are musicians and they're in bands. I'm like, how the hell do you ever get five people together to do anything at one time? I can't even get artists to drop off work and pick up work. I don't get it. But that's the culling. You'll cull people from any community. And if you're so bent on being an individual that you don't want to participate, then that's something that you need to figure out how to deal with. You know, that's why some people live out in the sticks and some people live in a city.
I just had another collaborative art project with Jackie Lima, who's a painter in Easton. She asked me for a poem about the river, the Delaware and Lehigh rivers coming together in Easton, and I had something I could give her. And then she had a painting that she had made that was about this. It was almost like the size of a crown that you would put on your head, and the poem was written on the inside of the painting. It was in a show in the Delaware Water Gap, and then we were at a Riverside art festival about a month ago, and Jackie Lima came with the painting, and I read the poem, but she spun the painting around. She spun the crown around like a turning circle, like a turning ring, and I read the poem as it was turning, so I couldn't read it the way you would normally read it on a piece of paper, so it was like a little bit of a performance piece. The next time we thought we would turn it the other direction, so I'd have to read it backwards. But that kind of, you know, working together collaboratively and then also taking it almost to the performance level is exciting and actually fun.
Peggy Campbell, I would like for us to end the interview with a reading of yours,
oh,
a poem that you wrote entitled Hands. Would you do that?
Yes, yes. Hands. Why was she hiding her hands? Ashamed of her fingernails, curved like beaks, and terrified that the bird of death had made his nest in her lungs as he had. I wish I had photographed her hands without a cigarette, or your hands removing the tumor, the way Paul Strand photographed George Brock's hands in quiet repose on a stone the shape of his trepanned skull. The encyclopedic left thumb reads the letter of the burr hole. Where have these hands been? Cross-hatched windows of skin look out over pools of knuckles, narrating line after line of the hand's work and the life lived. Between the tender bed and the nails, the quarter moon of infancy presides, its sweet face pressed against the keratin shell. Scaling the dorsal Venus mountain range, these hands have gripped the palms of fellow climbers. In love's anguished mime, they are finger birds with nerves of wire. They could have painted a portrait of my mother breathing the infinite sky.
Thank you, Peggy Campbell and Anthony Maracini, for joining us on Lehigh Valley Discourse today.
Thank you.
And best of luck with
your
projects in the future.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
This is John Pierce, your host. Glad to have you with us today. And remember to be gentle with your neighbor.